Today's April 6th. We are learning theodicy in the Bible, and we are up to Yirmiyahu 12. That means that we're just skipping for today, Malachim 18, 19. We're going to come back to that. Okay. Yirmiyahu 12 comes off the heels of the end of chapter 11, where Yirmiyahu rails against the people of his hometown, Anatot, who are trying to kill him. The last three psukim of Perek Yud Aleph, L'chein ko amar Hashem al anshei Anatot, ha-mevakshim et nafshecho le'mor, lo tinavei b'shem Hashem, v'lo tamut b'yadenu. Stop giving prophecy in the name of God, so that you shouldn't die by our hands. Right? So Yirmiyahu pronounces quite a harsh punishment on them, and that they will not return with the other Jews after the exile. They will not return. They will all die, either here before you leave, from the sword and from hunger, or you'll die in exile. None of your descendants will return. We'll talk about that at the very end of this class. For Anshei Anatot and the return after 70 years. Okay. Now there's another chapter in this book that seems to relate to Anatot. It's a machlokus in the Mefarshim, but I side very heavily with Radak, who says that chapter is talking about Anatot. It's chapter 16. Where Hashem tells Yirmiyahu, do not take a wife in this place. Do not take a wife, do not have children. This is, does not necessarily mean that Yirmiyahu was never married and never had children. Hashem says, do not take a wife in this place. Radak claims that Yechezkel was Yirmiyahu's son. How could he say that in light of this parak? Because Radak explains, don't take a wife in this place. Chapter 16 is one of the most devastating chapters in the book. And he says, whoever takes a wife in this place, she will die and your children will die, because that is the fate of this place. And he describes at great length and great specificity what will happen to the people in this place. It's gruesome. Radak goes through, it's a very long Radak, takes up the whole page, and he says that goes to various opinions, but what he's talking about, he claims it's not Yerushalayim, people did survive Yerushalayim. He's talking about Anatot. This place is your hometown. Don't get married here. You can get married in Yerushalayim, don't get married here. Don't live here anymore. Good Shabbos. By chapter 16, Yirmiyahu was not invited to live in Anatot anymore. Okay? Anatot was outside Yerushalayim. It was a city of banished Kohanim. That's where Shlomo banished Evyatar to live. It's Malachim Aleph, Perek Bet Pasuk Chaf Aleph. He banished Evyatar to live there because Evyatar supported Adoniyahu. So when Shlomo became king, he took care of business of everyone who followed Adoniyahu, so they shouldn't think of starting another insurrection at some point. You know what I'm talking about, right? Beginning Malachim Aleph. There's a little editor's note there that says, to fulfill the promise made by Shmuel about the house of Eli. Remember when he was asleep at night, he kept hearing when he thought it was Eli, it was God talking to him. So, the promise was that Eli's descendants wouldn't serve God in his Mikdash. Okay, that Mikdash is about to be built. And although Eli's sons, some descendants, Achimelech, remember they were wiped out by Shaul because Shaul helped David. Because Achimelech helped David, he killed all the families, only one child survived, Evyatar. Evyatar joined David, but then he made the mistake of siding with Adoniyahu over Shlomo. Fine. So to live in Anatot means that you're probably a descendant of Eli, which calls into question the claim made by Targum Yonasan and Rashi that Yirmiyahu's father doesn't just coincidentally have the same name as the current Kohen Gadol, Chilkiyahu, but he was the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol does not live in Anatot. No way. First of all, it's outside of Yerushalayim. The Kohen Gadol wouldn't live in Anatot. Right? First pasuk in Yirmiyahu says he's from Anatot, Beretz Binyamin. Okay. enough. So chapter 16 is the fall of Anatot and the destiny of all who raise families there. I'm letting you in on the secret, Yirmiyahu. Get out of there. Tell them that too. But as you know from the end of chapter 11, they don't want to hear that. We'll kill you if you keep speaking this way. I'm just trying to save you. You know. But, you know, it's falling on deaf ears. Okay? That's what created an English word called the Jeremiad. Have you heard the word? The Jeremiad. Look it up. It's a prediction of gloom. Usually the political sense. You want to say, if you give this man another 4 years, do you know what malaise this country is going to go through? Let me tell you, compare now to 4 years ago. Are you better off now? Ronald Reagan was very good at applying Jeremiads to Jimmy Carter. You see the word? It's come up. Jeremiad. It's an English word. You can use it in Scrabble. Right? I think it's unfair. Yirmiyahu is not the prophet of doom and destruction. He's the prophet of doom, destruction, and rebuilding. Does it mention a political sphere or just stam predictions?
It says that biblical and then Garrison is author is the same thing about politics.
Okay, usually we say politics. Anyway, there are lots of words in the that are based like that on Tanakh words, like a shibboleth. If you have a shibboleth, like it's a facade, not real. It's a shibboleth. From the story of Yiftah, when he had them say the word shibboleth, sibboleth, right? I mean, most of the words that are from the Bible are actually sizes of wine bottles. You ever see them? There's like six or seven different words in the names in Tanakh that are sizes of wine bottles. There's a Belteshazzar, there's a Nebuchadnezzar, I don't think there's a Sennacherib, but there's a Methuselah. I bet you can probably pick that whole list. There's Jeroboam is the size of a wine bottle. They get to be big, right? Like 7-10 gallons. I wonder what the biggest one is.
Rehoboam.
There is a Methuselah. What's the biggest one? Do they have pictures? There's like seven or eight. A Belteshazzar is the biggest. Alright, so those are biblical words too. Anyway, a Jeremiad is what Yirmiyahu is doing in chapter 16 and chapter 11. Right? While it's true that in this book there's no cohesion to the chapters necessarily. Right? Chapter 11. They're all over the place. Chapter 43 is Gedaliah's assassination. I mean, it's after the Churban. And then 44 is a message to Jehoiakim. The book is really very disjointed and probably done on purpose.
Why?
Just to show how difficult it was for Yirmiyahu to keep records while constantly being jailed and beaten and threatened. Right? Otherwise, why wouldn't Ezra or someone just put it in order? Or Baruch Benaria? Like I once made up a scenario that Yirmiyahu is in jail and Baruch Benaria is visiting him, and Yirmiyahu gives him like 30 pages. This, here, Baruch, I think I'm dying here. He spent the Churban in jail. Here, take this. These are all my notes from all my speeches. Take them and make a book out of it. And it fell out of his hand and it all got mixed up. And he just said, listen, Baruch said, what am I going to do, guys? They're coming to kill me right now. Just take it. Take away. Save yourself. Go, get out of here. And he just put it together the way he found it. Anyway, chapter 11 and chapter 12, however, are not disjointed. By the way, just to call this 11 and 12, that's a Christian made those delineations, I'm sure you know. If you look in the Masoretic text of how the Parshiot go, 11 goes right into 12. Right? Well, it says, Tzadikah Torah Hashem. There is a break. There is a break. Okay, so that's how chapter 11 ends, and I purposely am reading that together with 12 for a particular reason to discover what is Yirmiyahu's intention in chapter 12. Here it is. He starts off by saying, Tzadik ata Hashem ki yorive lecha. God, at the outset, I'm no Avraham, I'm no Habakkuk. I'm no David. What do these guys have in common with many others? They protest vehemently, as if though I'm in the right and I have the right to protest this way. Yirmiyahu starts off by saying, I'm less than these guys. You know, maybe he was a nar when he starts off in Perek Aleph, right? So who knows how old he is when he sees this. But whatever it is, he says, God, you have the tzidkus. I have no way arguing that you know that there's anything that I can consider a taina to you. Like Koheles or, you know, those guys. Right? So let's get it out there at the outset. Now, this is just maybe kissing up, like Eov's friends. Right? So he says, Tzadika Toshem Kirive Lecha, I admit at the outset, it's my feeble mind. I'm just an amoeba. Ach mishpatim adaber osach. So Hashem should tell him, okay, then shut up. But you don't mahar on. Don't say anything. Just keep quiet. Right? But God, you know, okay, so I started off that way. Let me just say, it's not personal, but I'm wondering, Madua derech rishoim tzolecha? Why do the wicked do so well? Why do they have such hatzlacha? So, what would be your answer? Because crime pays. Depends on the nature of the law enforcement in that place. Right?
Weird for this to come right after the ending of 11.
You'll see its connection shortly.
Because Hashem just says that they're going to suffer. And now he's saying, why would they be prosper?
Well, Hashem says they're going to suffer.
Right now
they're not. So he says, okay, I know everyone's getting their comeuppance. Everyone's getting what they deserve. But God, that's not my experience. So, I just want as simple as, Madua derech rishoim tzolecha. Why do they have such hatzlacha? Okay. Now, today we have surveillance. Like, it's hard to get away with things today, right? But, you know, there are criminals that work all the time on how to get by their surveillance, how to put on a mask, how to put on a different identity, and a, you know, whatever. But that's what they work in. They have to do the deed, and they have to get away with it. Right? So now what the Malbim does in his Perush to this section here in Yirmiyahu is to undo your paper on Eliphaz. Okay? He says this, and he slugs up Tzofar and Elihu also, Tzofar and Bildad. Basically, let's just take it apart one by one, statement by statement. Eov's friends, we all know this by now, tell him, man cannot be more righteous than God, so man gets what he deserves. Okay? This is what the righteous get, this is what the wicked get. And there are whole prokim in Eov that discusses, right? Since you are getting what we just said the wicked usually get, so you must be wicked. And the only way out of it is to test your ways, check out what you've been doing, your children, right? You know, it never comes through that Eov admits to his three friends that maybe my kids were enjoying life too much. Maybe it's hinted somewhere in his words today. But they say a few times in the book, your children must have been sinners to all die this so young. Right? Maybe it's you and your wife that deserve such a thing, right? Eov says over and over, I can deal with all the pain of my loss, but I can't deal with my friends insisting to me that I deserve it. Right? So he's saying that the Rasha, Yirmiyahu says, has hatzlacha. I don't know, anyone in his right mind can't see that. If he's living in a place where the law enforcement is not as firm as it needs to be, right? Obviously, different law codes will stress different things depending on their value system or to what extent they need to protect, right? I don't think if you steal a cow today, they'll kill you, but 150 years ago out in the West, they'd kill someone. Stealing one goat. That was the death penalty for rustling cattle. Right? So because that had... So anyway, with time, that can change. Right? Yechezkel Kaufman points out that no ancient civilization has the death penalty for kidnapping. Not one, but the Torah does. We just left incarceration. We just left slavery. You're going to take away a person's liberty? You killed him. Right? So that's called Nevi Yishu Mecharo. Sabi Yadom, Moshe Mas. Right? So that is the... So you see that law codes are going to stress different aspects of what to stress. The saying that the people who don't live by a code of honor and a value system, they're the guys with atzlacha. So what would Alifa say? No, it's going to catch up with them. It's fleeting. Right? It's not going to last. The Russia always gets his due. And you know what? Even him knowing that someone is looking for him, that he cheated on this, and he always has to worry about the, you know what I'm saying, the head of the government or the police catching up with him, or, you know what I'm saying? Just knowing that is enough to make his existence miserable. So what does Yirmiyahu say? That's quite wrong. Read the next words. The end of Pasuk 1. Shalu chobot debogim. No, they have shalva. These guys have inner peace. These guys are very pleased with their lives. They're not regretting anything. Right? Now look, sometimes a killer has remorse over something. Well, you know what? It's my job. That's what I do. You know, you had the Jews in Murder, Inc. who wouldn't work on Shabbos. Did you hear that? They wouldn't kill on Shabbos. That's my day off. All right, but it's what I do. What can I say? You know, it's my job. Right? In other words, does he have a conscience? No, they don't. What conscience? Shalom kol bog de baget. They finish their work and they have inner peace at home afterwards. There's some real pathologies in some of the concentration camp guards who are such perfect gentlemen. They had balls and dances and they were listening to the finest music, sipping the finest champagne after pushing buttons that killed 20 to 30,000 people during the day. Finest gentlemen. How could this be? Cultured and they danced, they waltzed to music every night. This is my job. So they have shalva. What are you talking about, Alifas? That these people have a miserable existence? Nonsense. Now, are there some people who struggle with their bad behavior? Okay. But my experience, says Yirmiyahu, is that shalu kopo debugged. So remember, one of the arguments Alifas made was that their children will never, there's nothing that they'll produce. It'll all die with them. What difference does it make? So it happens to them this year, it happens to them in 10 years. They will not be able to implant any of their bad behavior into anything. What are you talking about, Yirmiyahu says? Netatom. God, they're planting. They plant seeds. They plant seeds of their evil. So there was one place where the Malbim actually gives specific psukim, but it isn't. It's not one specific pasuk, it's 20 specific pasukim. Is that even if they do plant the seeds, those seeds will never take root. What seed can take root of such evil? The evil will catch up with them. It will fall under the burden of its own weight. Right? That's the theme of what was it called? The Tower? No, the Lord of the Rings, you know. That's basically the point. They can be very powerful, they can have the orcs, they can have the... But in the end, they're going to tick off the trees, they're going to tick off... Something is going to be ticked off because of their basic evil that's going to do them in. Right? You see, I don't know if it's historical, but You know, General Cornwallis, you've heard of him, right? In the Civil War? Well, you know, study American history, probably. But there was one of the most brilliant statisticians of all time in fighting battles, General Cornwallis. George Washington was a midget compared to him in status, you know, just... That's what I've read in the books. But, so how did he lose against such odds? How did George Washington defeat him? The answer is hubris, arrogance. Cornwallis traveled with something like 20 changes of perfect garments. He needed to be decked out with the, like what we call a tuxedo. Who goes to battle with 20 tuxedos? So when that hubris did him in. There's one very crucial battle where they captured his garments and put them on revolutionary soldiers at a far distance, and they wore them tied up to poles, and we said, "We captured 20 of your men. We're going to execute them if you don't retreat." And he retreated. They were revolutionary. They weren't. They were dressed like. And he looked in his binoculars, saw them from far. And he said, "Oh." Yeah. It's that so Eliphaz is so sure that that's how it works, right? But Yirmiyahu says, "I'm not sure, God." It says, "Natatam gam sharoshu." It takes root, actually. Yeah, but you know what? All right, there are three processes in planting something. You have to put a seed in the ground. You have to water it and then give it some bird feed, some feed. And then you have to make sure that it takes root. And then it has to bear fruit. Even if those wicked people do manage to put seeds in the ground, in the tatam, even if they manage to take root, it'll never make fruit because that takes too long. It'll never pass on their legacy of evil to another generation. And Yirmiyahu says, "What are you talking about? The Yelchu Gama Superi. They go on. They give over their evil to another generation." It goes on and on and on. How many generations has the mafia lasted? They took a real hit in the last 20, 30 years with new laws, RICO laws, and other things like that. The mafia's not as powerful as they were. You know? I don't know if you saw The Godfather. They're not powerful anymore as they once were. They still. There was a time when mafia was in control of kashrus in America. Really? In the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s, maybe even.
Here
in New York, all Chicago, all over. They want regulation. If there's something regulated where all Jews have to eat kosher, they want a piece of that. And they were good at enforcement. Anyone broke the rules, they would, that's it, forget it, cement slippers. Right? And they got their cut. They had cuts in everything, 60s, 60s, 70s, 80s, right? So there it is. They lasted how many generations? 2, 3, 4 generations. What was their undoing was then when they started getting into drugs. They Bashita stayed away from drugs for a long time. Then they saw the other group gangs were getting into drugs. They were making a lot more money. So they're saying, but I see Yahu Gama Superi. They last generation after generation. Right? Okay? So with two psukim, the Malbim says that Yirmiyahu does away with whole swatches of Eob's three friends. Amazing. Crazy. Let's read on a little bit. He says, "Karov atah b'fihem v'rachok mikil yoseihem." God, you're close to their mouths, but far from their innards or their hearts. You're close to their mouths, but you're far from their hearts. Now, what does that even mean? They kiss up to you. This is Yoke's three friends. What they say, well, I don't know what's in Eliphaz's heart. I don't know what he's doing himself behind closed doors, right? How do we acknowledge some of the people? We find out what they do privately after they're so public about. I mean, I love what happened to Jimmy Swaggart, the guy who said all Jews are going to hell. They won't take Jesus. They're going to go to hell. I remember seeing him. He was on Channel 9 for years. He's such a misa mishuna about what's going to happen to the Jews if they don't accept Jesus. He was shtupping every woman in his congregation and every secretary and every. What sickness. You go on the airwaves talking about the devil and the Jews. Well, you're doing that. Shouldn't you have to be perfect if you're going to go and talk like that publicly? I mean, you shouldn't talk like that. That's a sign of a lack of your perfection to talk like that in the first place, I'll say. But while you're doing it, you're hopelessly stripping all these women. And I remember seeing the confession on television, the tears streaming down his face. I remember the lips saying, I've sinned, I couldn't help myself. They ran after me. Yeah, I wanted to strangle him through the television. So, but here's the problem. The next pasuk says, "Vato Hashem yedatoni." God, you know me. This is not personal. You know me. Look into my heart. Tireini, look at me. Uvachanta libi, check my heart. Test my heart. I'm with you. I'm with libi itach. Hatikem kitzon l'tivcha v'aktishem liyom harega. Set them up, God, for the slaughter like sheep. Prepare them for their death. So Rashi asks the question on this pasuk: who is he talking about? Who is this? Who is he asking to put sent to their death? So Rashi says Nebuchadnezzar. But then Rashi knows the weakness of that argument. Why do we want it to be Nebuchadnezzar? He's the enemy. I don't like to hear Yirmiyahu saying talking this way about Jews. If you hear of a medrash, it's a beautiful medrash. It appears in the Hamdama of Mechilta. Mechilta compares three Nevi'im. One is who is Toveya Ba'av. One is the Av meaning God. One is Toveya Ben. And one is a combination of both. The Navi's job is to press God's case before the people and to put the people's case before God. Right? He might have to do more of one than the other at times, right? So the Medrash says, who is the one who cares so much about God that he doesn't even flout his relationship with his people? Who goes to God? Eliyahu. At Har Carmel, God says, so Eliyahu, what's bothering you? This is the Torah of Parshas Pinchas, if it's not one of the 3 weeks. It's pretty common. Because Pinchas says, "Tano is king." See, when God asks Eliyahu, we just did this great spectacle at Har Carmel with his priests of Baal, and now they're still trying to kill him. God, what kind of place is this? Right. Actually, that's what we skipped today, Malachim 18:19. Right. So Eliyahu was complaining bitterly before God. The question there is, how far can we blame God for our problems? Eliyahu tells God, "God, you turned their heart astray." Talking like Habakkuk, right? I'll tell you why your Torah is weak. I'll tell you why there's no justice. Why should anyone have more justice than you? The judge of the world doesn't do justice, so why should we? That's what people are saying. Afterwards, he says, I was Meshuggah God. I was saying, please understand me. I wasn't myself. I couldn't. Okay. So Eliyahu, by complaining about the people, says, Kano, Kanesi, Lashem. He says it twice. He says, I'm zealous for you, God. I'm the only one left that doesn't worship Baal. The second time that he says it, God tells him the next pasuk, take Elisha ben Shaphat, Navi Tachtel. You're fired. I don't need a Navi to speak against Bnei Israel. I know what they are. I need a Navi like Moshe. I didn't see Noah when I told him I want to destroy the world, like Avraham did. That's why Yeshayahu refers to the flood as May Noach. That's a chutzpah. Noach saved the world. Why are you putting them? Because if Avraham was around, there wouldn't have been a flood. when Moshe heard God say, "I'm going to destroy Bnei Israel," what word did he use? Use all these letters. God, I'm not going to let you destroy me. What? So when Eliyahu talks that way against the Israel, Hashem says, "You're fired. I don't need a Navi to do that." Okay, who's the opposite? Who's the Navi that cares so much about Bnei Israel? He's willing to flout God again and again and again. "I don't even care if you kill me. Kill me. I want you to kill me, God." 3-4 times in the book, he asks to die. He behaves in a way that he's fine with dying. And one time, he explicitly says, "I want to die. Kill me now." What? He says, "I wish I was never born." He never says, he says, "Are you? Choose death over life." It doesn't mean that you're going to actually kill yourself. It's just that death would be welcome. I talk to some old people that way. They just like to go to sleep quietly and not wake up in the morning. They're not going to kill themselves, though. They're 102 and they just, I can't take the pain anymore. Anyway, but Yirmiyahu does talk that way in chapter 8. Nivchar Magas Mechaim. But no, who's the Navi? Come on. Yonah, of course. So, Yonah is the Tovei Olabet. And there's a medrash that Hashem says, "Vayomer Hashem el Yonah Shenis." Right? Shenis below Shlishis. Right? Hashem doesn't talk to Yonah anymore because you're fired. If you're only going to be for one, you're fired. I'm not saying this. This is all the Mechilta. This is a medrash, a very early medrash. And who's the one that has both? Now we're talking Yirmiyahu. Shenemar gives you a proof text. Nachnu Hashanu Umarinu. It's a pasuk in Echa. Ata lo samachta. We have rebelled, right? And turned astray. You didn't forgive. So you see in that state, in that one pasuk, that you see both. The top is Tovea Ba'av. You know, I'm justifying whatever you've done to us. But God, enough already. Fellow Salata, come on, forgive us already. Enough. I'm ready. Right? You see it? So, this does not mean to say, I don't want to read the Machilta this way, that every single prophecy of Yirmiyahu has to be some kind of combination of Tovei Olam and Tovei Olam. Ours certainly is not. Right? But maybe that's why Rashi insisted that he's talking about Nebuchadnezzar. Because I can't believe that Yirmiyahu would talk this way about his own people, no matter what they put him through. Otherwise, how can you say someone who asks God to kill his own people like sheep to the slaughter is at all a Tovei Olam? Do you understand the question, though? This does not. But just because this pasuk has both the same pasuk does not mean to say that every prophecy of Yirmiyahu has to be some kind of combination. No more than, if you don't mind this intrusion, than a centrist has to take a centrist attitude towards everything. A centrist is someone that if you put in a bundle all of his attitudes towards these 4,000 things, you pile them in a pile, they're pretty much in the center. But some of the things you have to take a strong stance in the other direction. And then they balance. Right? So too, if you take all of your Yirmiyahu's prophecies and put them together, they'll balance. But that doesn't mean that sometimes he wasn't driven to an extreme. Except the idea, okay? So I would just say that in our instance here, that if you look at the psukim, Rashi himself admits there's no way that this pasuk can refer to Nebuchadnezzar. I know why Rashi says it, because he doesn't like the fact that Yirmiyahu would talk this way about his people. He's talking about the people of Anatot. That's why I read the end of 11 together with this. Right? He just predicted they're not coming back. God, you know what? Don't wait that long. Hit him now. Right? Can you look at the end of... Look at Pasuk Bet and prove to me that this has to be Jews. Why would that be an objection to Babylonia? Why would they think that God should be close to their their hearts or their mouths. God is not close to Babylonian mouths, right? This is Jews. Like when you read Tehillim chapter 109, it's devastating. You say Tehillim?
I did Tanakh all the time.
The whole Tanakh?
Yeah.
Kabbalah. So you remember Tehillim chapter 109?
I don't remember.
In some Tehillims it says, Yesh shelo omrim te perek zu. Some people don't like to ever say this perek. Go ahead, read some of it. You say you're reading something? You know? God kill his children, kill his wife, kill him, make his wife a widow, make his children orphans. Right? Why? He tell the first reason he gives why I want this to happen to him. Really? That's a reason to make a man's children orphans? So, in the very least, it's clear he's talking about Jews here. He's not talking about Moabites there. I wouldn't say that Moabites deserve destruction because they're not learning Chesed. Maybe that's a reason that they shouldn't marry into our nation, but that's not a reason to beg God to destroy a nation. Right? Unless he's talking about his own people. So to hear, because of that similar kind of thing, I would argue that this is talking about Hebrews, Israelites here. Right? And that just bolsters my point, is that even someone who's Tovei Lav or Tovei Leben is allowed some dispensation to, you know. Okay. Here's the upshot of the class. I'm not familiar with Maamar Chazal that says this. I wish it was. But all I have to do is the facts. Sefer Nehemiah lists all the people who came back with Ezra. It lists how many family members came from various families and the places they came from. Totaling 42,360. So most of the lists are 250 here, 300 there, 270 here. And they're pretty precise lists. 128 there, 327 there. Really precise numbers, not round numbers, that usually you find in Tanakh. Right? One of those places, 123 people came from Anatot. It's in Nehemiah and in Ezra. Both books, people come from Anatot. Same number. Right? So, I would say that this is not the only time this happens in Yirmiyahu or Tanakh, for that matter. When Yirmiyahu predicted a 70-year galus, and Hananiah ben Azur said it will only be 2 years, Yirmiyahu said, "Halavai, I wish it would be so. I hope that your prophecy is right." Gemara the end of Sota says Yirmiyahu went a little overboard in flattery here, and he said, "But if we do return after 2 years, that's not a sign that I'm a liar. That's a sign that you listened to me, you did a great tshuva. But I'll tell you when we'll know that he's a liar is when 2 years pass and we don't return, because God can always go back on a bad promise. You don't know when his shvuah made it." You don't know. Keep hoping. If you can always move away from an evil decree. Right? Or at least the evil of the decree. So 123 people from Anatot returned. That's the upshot. So this is the Maamar Chazal I'm looking for. But I can say it if I want. It's my class. Is that the reason why they returned is because he said this. Not to spite any of them, but to just say the people were, you know, the people afterwards were so moved, and they said, this is what a prophet once said about our city? Oh my goodness, we really have to. It's because Yirmiyahu said this that the people of Anatot returned, right? I don't know, this could be it. Because he says in chapter 16, that Radak says to talk about Anatot. The end of chapter 11, he says explicitly, Anatot is not coming back after we return. And it seems that in the beginning of chapter 12, this is a continuum. And he's talking about begging God. So God says, really? You want me to destroy your own hometown? You know what, Yirmiyahu? I'm gonna give them an extra chance. So the bottom line is that the people of Anatot, if people of Anatot return in Nehemiah, that's one of the best prophecies in Tanakh. It's one of the best, not prophecies, but not prophecy of Yirmiyahu, one of the best stories in Tanakh. The people of Anatot returned, for goodness sakes. Look, Yirmiyahu in chapter 22 says this young king, Jehoiachin, he calls him Knayahu, let him die childless. No king shall ever, from his loins, shall ever sit on God's throne. But he doesn't call the descendant a king. He calls the descendant a chotam. No chotam. Very strange when you read it. He says, why are you calling him that? No chotam from Knayahu will ever sit on God's throne. Knayahu was taken captive into Babel at the age of 18. He probably didn't have children yet. Right? But we do find that he has a grandson in Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah. And he's mentioned in Sefer Haggai. That grandson's father was named Shaltiel. And I only know this from Divrei Hayamim. And that Shaltiel had a son named, you want to get his name? You know? Zerubbabel. The last pasuk of Sefer Haggai, listen to this, Haggai, which is all about rebuilding the base of Mikdash, he says, Vayom ahu nu'um Hashem tzokot ekachacha Zerubbabel ben Shaltiel avdi nu'um Hashem v'samticha kachotom kiluducha b'chayu nu'um Hashem tzokot. You will be my chotom on my throne. Now you see why Yirmiyahu used that word. No, Haggai used that word because of Yirmiyahu. Right? Because it was obvious you can't call Zerubbabel a melech. Every leader of Israel now is only serving in any political position because of the largesse and the generosity of the Persians. You're not going to call him a melech. They'll go back on all they're doing for you if you rebel to that extent. So call him a chotam. Chotam is someone who signs decrees or something. He has a signature ring, and so the kings gave them. The Persians had those kind of rings, right? Like Achashverosh gives to Mordechai at the end of the story, right? Ibn Ezra, by the way, in his commentary to Nehemiah, says Zerubbabel was Nehemiah, same person. It's far flung, but okay, so be it. But you see, so there's two prophecies where Yirmiyahu says something categorically: the people of Anatot will not return, and that Knayahu will never even have a descendant. Much less a chotam on my throat. Not only did he have a descendant, he was a chotam. Because good prophecies can always be undone. And that's the answer to our question. Okay? The wicked people thrive. They look like they're thriving. They are really thriving. They take root. They plant seeds. They take root. They fruit. They go on. But understand, whether it's three generations, four generations, we may not live to see it. I see it's the Hatzlacha. That bothers me. Just have faith. It'll even out. Okay. You know where this ended, right?
Yeah.